This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 31st, 2013. In Boston, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, senators question Obama administration officials on government spying programs as new information on the secret surveillance court comes out. The sentencing phase of the Bradley Manning court-martial gets underway. In Mexico, indigenous communities fight a foreign investor's plan to reopen a controversial gold mine. And we'll go to Myanmar to look at how civil society is developing after decades of military rule. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Voters are going to the polls today in Zimbabwe in the first national election since 2008, when violence triggered a political crisis in the southern African country. The presidential election once again pits longtime ruler Robert Mugabe against Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai. Voting irregularities are already emerging. FSRN's Gary Kaichanza reports.
Hundreds of voters were turned away after finding their names were left off the voter rolls. Most of the affected registered during the extended voter registration period. The aspiring voters were denied access to the polls, even though they were carrying voter registration papers bearing their identity numbers in their assigned polling locations. The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission has been running notices on radio and newspapers saying workers would accept the registration papers at the polls. FSRN visited a number of polling stations in Harare and witnessed several people being turned away. MDCT Party National Organizing Secretary Nelson Chamisa told reporters the voter roll problem is a cause for concern.
So those are issues we are raising with ZEC, and we've actually deployed our team to raise those issues with ZEC, hoping that they will be rectified.
Election Commission Chair Rita Makarao says that they have corrected the problem and ordered polling officers throughout the country to allow the affected to vote in any polling station. Vote counts begin this evening. Yesterday, Robert Mugabe said he would step aside if polls favored Morgan Tsvangirai. The government has deployed security forces in several areas to stem any potential violence. Garika Ichaunza, FSRN, Harare.
The number of civilian casualties in Afghanistan is up 23% in the first half of this year. The UN assistance mission in Afghanistan finds nearly 4,000 civilians have died. UN Radio's Jerry Adams has more on the latest report.
It said the main factors driving the spike were the increased use of improvised explosive devices, IEDs, by anti-government elements, particularly in areas populated or frequented by civilians. The report also noted increased civilian casualties due to targeted killings and attacks against civilian government workers, as well as fighting between Afghan armed forces and anti-government elements, and high-level threats and intimidation.
Deaths of women and children rose 38% in that same time period. Supporters of human rights attorney Lynn Stewart rallied in New York City today in support of her bid for compassionate release from federal prison. Stewart is serving a 10-year sentence stemming from her defense of Omar Abdel-Rahman. She was convicted of providing material support to terrorists for passing messages on her client's behalf. Stewart is currently suffering from breast cancer. Her previous release request had been turned down, but now her lawyer says the judge will reconsider because Stewart has less than 18 months to live. The hearing is scheduled for this afternoon. In other news from New York, coastal communities who were impacted when Superstorm Sandy struck last autumn converged on Lower Manhattan today, demanding a refocusing of recovery efforts. FSRN's Peter Rue has more.
Many who rallied Wednesday afternoon lost their homes or jobs to the storm. They say disaster dollars have been slow to arrive, and federal and local governments aren't doing enough. And Maya Gelman is policy director for the Alliance for a Just Rebuilding, a coalition of labor, community, and environmental groups. She says Sandy compounded already existing housing and employment crises that she hopes recovery efforts will address.
There will be billions and billions of dollars invested in the city in the recovery. The federal money will probably be something around $15 billion, and the city anticipated more than $20 billion in its strategic initiative for recovery and resilience. And it's really critical that that money not go to rebuilding the same conditions that existed before the storm.
Demonstrators' demands include affordable housing and the sustainable rebuilding of infrastructure destroyed by the storm. As the New York mayoral race intensifies, storm victims want the next mayor to heed their calls for a just reconstruction. Peter Rue, FSRN, New York.
And finally, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans says law enforcement does not need to obtain a warrant to access location data from cell phones. Two of the court's three judges ruled Tuesday this information belongs to the phone company and not the phone user, and therefore police don't have to prove probable cause of a crime to track someone. The ACLU, which is litigating the case, argues this legal justification is flawed because it was established before the widespread use of electronic communications. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Boston. New revelations about the breadth of the National Security Agency's mass spying programs came to light today. In addition to collecting data about Americans' phone records, the NSA collects information from emails and web searches without individual warrants. Senators convened this morning to question government officials about these spying programs and demanded more transparency and more oversight. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Just hours before facing the Senate Judiciary Committee, officials from the Office of National Intelligence released the secret court order that authorized the collection of millions of individual phone records from Verizon. The document, which was originally going to be kept classified until 2038, has large sections blacked out and redacted, but confirms that the government has been storing, quote, all call data records for communications between the United States and abroad, or wholly within the United States. FBI Deputy Director Sean Joyce defended this program Wednesday, along with many others conducted under the Patriot Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, by saying they have kept the country safe by helping federal agents foil terror plots.
And I think we need to frame this by understanding who the adversary is and what they're trying to do. And they're trying to harm America. They're trying to strike America. And what we need is we need all these tools.
Several lawmakers were not satisfied by this justification. Vermont Democrat and committee chair Patrick Leahy said the executive branch shouldn't have the sole authority to determine the balance between national security and privacy.
We could have more security if we strip search everybody who came into every building in America. We're not going to do that. We have more security if we closed our borders completely to everybody. We're not going to do that. If we put a wiretap on everybody's cell phone in America, if we search everybody's home. But there are certain things, certain areas of our own privacy that we Americans expect. And at some point, you have to know where the balance is.
Leahy also raised concerns about a top-secret government surveillance program called X-KeyScore, which was revealed Wednesday in documents leaked by former intelligence contractor Edward Snowden and published by The Guardian. Using X-KeyScore, analysts at the National Security Agency and the private companies it hired could comb through the databases of the emails, Facebook chats, web searches, and browsing histories of millions of individuals. One document says the program gives the government access to, quote, nearly everything a typical user does on the internet. No warrant, court order, or official NSA approval is necessary for such a search. Several lawmakers on the committee, including Minnesota Democrat Al Franken, said the existence of X-KeyScore and other recently revealed programs should not have been kept secret. He said it's, quote, bad for privacy and bad for democracy when the government only makes information public in response to a leak by a whistleblower.
I don't want a situation where the government is transparent only when it's convenient for the government. When it's ad hoc transparency, that doesn't engender trust, I don't think.
Franken says he'll introduce a bill this week to force the government to disclose how many Americans have had their information collected under FISA and allow private companies to disclose how many government orders for private user data they have received. The Yahoo Corporation asked the government for permission to reveal this information earlier this month, and the government announced this week that it will begin a multi-month process to determine whether or not they can declassify it. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Today, the sentencing phase of the trial against Army Private Bradley Manning began at Fort Meade. Manning was convicted Tuesday of 20 of the 22 charges he faced, including charges under the Espionage Act. For more on the details of the convictions and what's next, we're joined by Elizabeth Goitin, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks very much.
Military Judge Lynn said that Manning faces up to 136 years in prison on the 20 charges. What do government prosecutors need to prove in this phase of the sentencing?
Well, things get a little tougher for them now because the factors that are relevant at the sentencing hearing are some of the factors that were considered by the judge not to be relevant at the guilt phase, including Bradley Manning's motive and whether or not his disclosures caused serious harm. And these issues are issues that actually are not as easy for the government as some of the issues about whether or not Bradley Manning actually accessed and disclosed these documents. So it's going to be a tougher road for them to hoe, I think.
So his motivations and also whether or not the leaks caused harm. Manning was acquitted of the aiding the enemy charge. Government prosecutors claimed in that charge that he had knowingly given intelligence to the enemy through WikiLeaks. That was not proven. Does that acquittal change how the sentencing will take place or what the burden of proof will be?
Well, that's interesting. It really doesn't in theory, because in theory, the sentencing hearing will only address, you know, the harm and the motive on those particular charges for which he was acquitted. But certainly the fact that the government did not produce, despite its best efforts, any evidence that Manning knew that Al-Qaeda would be seeing and accessing this information. That right there does say something about what the government will be able to prove about his motive.
Now, to go to that question of harm and to provide some context about some of the information that Manning leaked, he disclosed hundreds of thousands of documents. They included a video of a 2007 helicopter attack that shows U.S. soldiers firing on unarmed civilians and children in Baghdad. There were incident reports in Afghanistan that revealed a U.S.-run assassination squad. Then there were the diplomatic cables that showed the U.S. spied on U.N. officials, that the FBI trained Egypt's security forces that then committed torture, and that the administrations of both Bush and Obama thwarted international attempts to investigate torture. Much of these details were not known before the leak. What is in this information that the government is pointing to that would put U.S. national security at risk?
That's a good question. There were original classification authorities who testified at the hearing and spoke about their decisions or the reasons why the information was classified and why it could harm national security. You know, risk to national security is often very much in the eye of the beholder. It's often a subjective judgment. It's not hard to imagine national security consequences to almost anything if you get creative enough.
Manning was found guilty of five Espionage Act offenses. The Center for Constitutional Rights has called that act a discredited relic of the World War I era, created as a tool to suppress political dissent and anti-war activism. How could this conviction affect cases brought against other people who leak information, such as Edward Snowden, the NSA contractor who revealed extensive surveillance of Americans or others?
Well, unfortunately, this discredited relic appears to be enjoying a bit of a renaissance. It's being used far more commonly than it's ever been used before in cases involving disclosures of classified information to the media. So these convictions, if they stand on appeal, will set a precedent for the next, make it easier to bring the next Espionage Act case against a national security leaker, even if that leaker is a whistleblower and is simply bringing to light government misconduct that never should have been classified in the first place.
Elizabeth Goitin is co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. She joined us to discuss the sentencing phase for Army Private Bradley Manning, which began today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Foreign investment in Mexico's mining sector has expanded dramatically over the past decade, and it's raising tensions in some local communities. The most contentious conflicts have arisen in indigenous communities, where residents say the government failed to inform and consult local populations before handing out 50-year mining permits to foreign investors. In Oaxaca, one permit would reopen a mine which local communities fought to close down. FSRN's Shannon Young reports.
Calpulalpan de Mendez is a picturesque mountain community. It's the only village in the state of Oaxaca with the special designation of Magic Town, a title given by the federal government to promote tourism. Calpulalpan also has a history of silver and gold mining going back more than two centuries. But now town residents are in a determined fight against foreign mining interests. Salvador Aquino is a member of Calpulalpan's Council of Elders, an important advisory body within the local indigenous governance system.
Precisely because of our experience of knowing what it means to be a miner, what mining work entails, and what the consequences mean in terms of water pollution, of the devastation of aquifers, of the destruction of forests, and of contamination of communal land. The legacy of these 200 years of experience led the community and the Council of Elders to the conclusion that it was no longer possible to continue with the exploitation of minerals, considering the experience left us with devastation in terms of lives and communal territory.
When Aquino was young, his father worked in the nearby Natividad mine and died of silicosis, an occupational lung disease. Aquino says decades ago, Calpulalpan was known informally as the widow's town due to the high death rate for miners.
Pues a los que trabajaban en el interior de mina, pues les daban su casco, su lámpara.
Another resident with 14 years' experience in the Natividad mine is Fernando Felix Mendez. He says workers were given helmets, lamps, and gloves, but no masks or respirators.
That's why all of us who have worked inside the mine have lung problems, because part of the job involves working with machines, which use air pressure and are heavily greased so as not to seize up. So inside of the mine, there's a type of haze that forms from all the dust, which even the water sprayer can't control completely, and over time, it affects the lungs.
Mendez stopped working in the mine in 1997, when it was still under Mexican ownership. The gold mine is now owned by Vancouver, Canada-based Sundance Minerals. In 2006, the town won a temporary stay of operations over environmental code violations, including the illegal dumping of hazardous waste, and the mine has been inactive ever since. But the federal government could reverse the stay if it determines certain regulatory conditions have been met.
La minería de hace 20 años es...
Vicente Aranda is the Director of Industries and Mines at Oaxaca's State Secretary of Tourism and Economic Development. He says work safety and environmental standards have improved in the last 20 years. And while Canada's laws don't apply in Mexico, he points to its regulatory standards as further evidence that foreign companies will respect Mexico's environment.
In order to be able to do business as a company on the Canadian stock market, they have to be seen in a good light.
Aranda also says foreign mining companies contribute to local infrastructure projects in the communities where mines operate and help fund economic programs. But people living in Calpulalpan remain opposed to the resumption of regional mining activities because of concerns over what the operations could do to the local environment. In recent years, Calpulalpan has developed its own sustainable economic model based on its communally owned natural resources. In addition to its nationally recognized ecotourism project, it also bottles water from its mountain spring, runs a sustainable forestry service, and has a small-scale gravel quarry. All of these projects are cooperatively administered by the town assembly. Salvador Aquino of the Council of Elders says the mining company's offer to fund local projects doesn't compare to what the town already has.
Mining companies give us money to fix up the church, give us money for a school and a hospital, and to pretty up the town. That's what they proposed in exchange for us giving them permission to come in and exploit gold and silver resources. We said no. They said we oppose progress. What we oppose is the devastation of our resources. For us, progress isn't about looting gold and silver. It's about the protection of our resources, because they have a moral and ethical meaning for us as a community.
People in Calpulalpan remain concerned that, despite their opposition, the federal government will allow mining operations to resume. They've also heard of plans to license an open-pit gold mine above the town's remaining aquifer. They are promising to do whatever it takes to prevent that from happening. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Myanmar, the Southeast Asian country also known as Burma, is transitioning toward democracy after a half century of harsh military rule, and it's an open question exactly how civil society groups will engage in the new political landscape. Activists say while they now have more freedom to fight land grabs and other injustices, they also face a lack of resources and powerful business interests as their activism becomes bolder. In the second half of our two-part series on Myanmar's transition, FSRN's Mike Ives has more from Yangon.
Yu Po Pew sits in a crowded Yangon donut shop. He is something of an anomaly here, not just because he talks so loudly and breathlessly that onlookers swivel their heads to watch him, but also because he is one of Myanmar's few civil rights lawyers.
Most of our farmers are poor clans, so they have no abilities and they have no money to hire the lawyers. I will serve as the volunteers, lawyer, volunteer, legal consultants, and then in return, these poor farmer clients, hire our law associates to protect their rights.
He says he's currently working pro bono on more than 100 cases in which more than 20,000 farmers are fighting for their land. The only problem? The $4,000 he received in grants from an international aid program in the last few months is barely enough to keep his lights on. Myanmar's courts are hopelessly corrupt, he says, and the legal process is heavily tilted toward crony capitalists.
Land nationalization law provides that land shall be seized for the benefit of the state, shall be seized by the state, on behalf of the state for the benefit of the state. So, in the case of the most case of the land acquisitions, these lands has been seized for the benefit of the crony communities, not for the benefit of the state's interests.
Yu Po Pew's predicament highlights a shifting landscape for Myanmar's activists and civil society groups operating here in Yangon and across the country. On one hand, the country has a long tradition of grassroots activism and advocacy, even in spite of its authoritarian government. And a recent easing of censorship regulations is enabling local media to pay close attention to land grabs and other cases of government-sponsored injustice. But activists say grassroots organizing here can be a tentative, disorganized, and ineffective affair. And although Myanmar is reforming at a swift pace, its government is affiliated with extremely powerful commercial interests that hold immense sway over parliament and the courts. Cha Tu is the director of Puangku, one of Myanmar's leading umbrella groups for smaller grassroots NGOs. Cha Tu's organization has helped to advise and support the farmers of Awan Sok, the activists with the Dewey Development Association, and a range of other people and groups that oppose the government's new development policies.
We would say that we are quite a risk-taking organization because of our initial idea even during the restricted environment, we encourage local group when they receive our money. At the time, the state and the, civil society relation is very tense.
He says many small groups have been working quietly for years to fill in gaps in municipal services, for example, by hosting municipal blood drives or raising funds for families that can't afford to bury their dead.
The way we operate during the environment is we work under the umbrella of the INGOs. We form a consortium. For example, the INGO who have a official operating permission from the government. When we want to work in the Kachin area, we use that the INGO who operate in the area. So we work under that.
Another problem for Myanmar's civil society is the country has very few well-staffed, locally run nonprofits that can plan and coordinate long-term campaigns. Even established ones operate on a shoestring budget, and their directors complain that international NGOs are increasingly poaching their staff by offering them considerably higher salaries. Take the Biodiversity and Nature Conservation Association, one of Myanmar's oldest environmental organizations. Its cramped headquarters are in a top floor of a residential building on the outskirts of Yangon. There's no elevator, the power supply is spotty, and the internet is as slow as mud, if it even works at all.
5 or 10 years ago, if the government say you move, you move. That's all. If the government says, I'll give you 20,000 for your 1 acre of paddy field, you take it. Don't argue.
The association's chair, the veteran conservation biologist Tony Tinla, says in addition to a lack of funds and a slow exodus of staff to international NGOs, grassroots groups suffer from another big problem, lack of focus.
There are some local societies which is very much into anti-development. But they also need some knowledge. You can't object all the developments. Our country is very poor, you know. We need development, right? And they are just objecting because they think, oh, this is something to object. It's the government. This is the thing government is doing. We have a chance to object. We are not objecting. They don't have the knowledge also. We also need to educate them.
He says a perfect example is the recent copper mine protests in central Myanmar.
It went very bad, you know, and all these riots and, you know, all this, it happened. Now the government has to form a commission with Aung San Suu Kyi leading that, right? So it became a very big issue. It should be not go to that stage. It should be settled very wisely, not reaching that stage.
Tony Tinla says he can easily understand why Myanmar's people would be excited to throw themselves headlong into politics after so many years under a harsh military regime. But he says activist politicians and journalists must all make a better effort to educate themselves on the issues, and above all, to exercise patience and restraint. Only then, he adds, will Myanmar live up to its full potential. Mike Ives, FSRN, Yangon, Myanmar.
This is the second of a two-part series on Myanmar. To check out the first report from Mike Ives on the cost of economic development and land grabs and the push for foreign investment, go to fsrn.org. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Molly Stentz and Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Carla West. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can find sights and sounds from FSRN's Global Reporters. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Boston, I'm Dorian Marina.